So these are a couple of quick anecdotes about silos. So I have a silo sex story, which is a historian at Harvard just wrote a book called How the Hippies Saved Physics. This is kind of to judge. Oh, sorry.
He's the head of science, technology, and society at MIT, David Kaiser.
Sorry about that. Okay, so it's called How the Hippies Saved Physics. And it's sort of to judge King's thing, because there was this boom-bust thing that happened in physics education. So all of a sudden in the 60s, there was like all these physicists out there couldn't get any jobs. And so they got together at Berkeley and did this. Anyway, it's a whole story. You can read about it. But one of the key players in that was a guy named Fritjof Capra. And Capra wrote this book called The Tao of Physics, okay, in which he points out the relationship between complementarity in quantum physics and the Taoist yin-yang thing. Okay. And if you don't believe this, you look at Niels Bohr's coat of arms that he created to become part of the Order of the Elephant, and the center of his coat of arms is the yin-yang diagram. So it's not just Capra that's saying this. But I had Capra in a high school one time. This is in my lecture series that we do. And Capra's talking to these students, and this one student makes this comment. He goes like, he says, you know, I'm just graduating from high school. This is the first class I've ever been in where I could talk about science and religion in the same classroom. Who's interesting? Anyway, so there's a couple more. The last thing I'm going to say, this analogy between medical education and engineering education silos. I've worked in and out of the medical education area. And there was a conference or a colloquium or something at Oregon Health and Sciences University one year, and they were asking, just cut through it, they're asking this graduating medical student, they said, what, you know, you got all this stuff what was missing from your education? You know, you're graduating, now you could be. So he says, how to deal with people, how to treat people as people. You know, he said, I got all this, the meat, you know, how to deal with the meat, but I didn't get anything about the education. The dean, at that point, pipes in, and he goes like, we don't have time for that stuff. He goes, there's too much, we want to cram more, you know, biochemistry down them, all these new things are coming on. Now, Oregon University system, I've gone around to the deans of engineering, I know them pretty well, and every time I go around them, I say, hey, we need a course in, you know, history and philosophy of engineering or something like that, or any of this stuff that we're talking about. And they go like, well, which of my faculty do you want me to fire in order to make room for FTE for that course? And now, here's the educational research payoff. And this is ASEE stuff 10 years ago. Are we cramming too much down the engineers? Are we cramming too much down the medical students? Well, you can do studies of that, okay? So you check with them 6 months after they graduate. You check with them 3 years after they graduate. And you ask them a couple questions. Can you pass this test that you passed in medical school? No. How much of what you learned in medical school or how much you learned in your engineering education was actually relevant to the job that you have? Very low. Very low. And most people come out of engineering, you ask them that question, they go like, oh, of course. They crammed all this stuff down us and we didn't really need it, and you know, there's all the defenses of that. But again, this goes back to ABET, which is the gorilla in the room that nobody's talking about. And we need to take them over and say, hey, this is baloney. But the resistance is, which of the engineering faculty are we going to get rid of in order to have some humanities in there? Anyway.
Okay. Oh, we have Ted.
Just to pick up on a portion of those last comments, how medical education has worked, I'd like to bring up a program with which I have some firsthand familiarity. It's called the Joint Medical Program, and it's joint between the University of California, San Francisco, and the Berkeley campus. It was actually started at the emphasis of members of the California State Legislature about 45 years ago. But it supplies 10% of UCSF's incoming class, and it does so by those students taking the first 2 years of medical education in 3 years, and as the rest of those 3 years, the student undertakes a master's degree in a pertinent field. All of this was aimed very much at humanizing the medical practitioner. And it's had its ups and downs, but on the whole been very successful. That's another thing that could perhaps be brought into our thinking as a model for engineering.
Okay, I have one quick comment before Larry. I wanted to point out, too, the importance of alumni, as was mentioned in the last comment, and other sort of stakeholders in all of this, that while the curriculum is owned by the faculty, bringing in alumni, polling them, polling other practitioners about how to design this new program, I think you can both have ideas and a source for political maneuvering and strength in implementing.
I have three comments, and each are short. One, on alumni, how do you judge the worth of an innovation that you're making? You want to look at your alumni. And the way I would do it, I would look 10 years down the road and see how much alumni giving has gone up as a measure of, well, anyway. The second point is concerns Judd's suggestion. I think there are all three, I think it was, particularly the one about courses, required courses, if you're pre-med. And but there you said that you'd have to give up, what I heard was the notion of community. I don't think it necessarily follows that you have to give up the notion of community because I think actually that would work pretty well. Someone mentioned the minors, and was it Jane? You know, the minors, identifying with the minors that they were taking as their intellectual home. The final point is about, someone mentioned the need for a champion. So I would like to nominate four people. Jennifer Rudolph, Ann McCants, or Sharon Jones.
Please, a comment from Susan, and then we'll go over.
I would just like to point out that in my research on the MIT Smith, well, it doesn't hold true everywhere, but across the four schools we studied, women were relegated to managers of the projects. You just named four women to take on a management function. It's housekeeping.
Okay, Carl Pfister, Berkeley. I have to disclose that I chaired a board that produced one of the reports on Professor Silby's slide. So I apologize for that. I want to pick up on something Domenico said. We need a champion, a leader, and you need a following. But I submit, before the leader can lead the following, you need to have a well-defined design objective. And that design objective ought to reflect, say, in this case, a market or some reason for being the Pied Piper of Hamelin. And I want to call attention to something that no one has mentioned. It's an article that appeared in the fall 2014 Bridge, which is a publication of the NAE, and it's a study done by a Professor Marie Thursby of Georgia Tech. And among other things, she produced this bit of data. And this is year 2008. 12.6 million people whose highest degree was in a science or engineering field, 12.6 million. Only 3.9 million worked in science and engineering jobs. I mean, it seems to me that's a compelling design objective right there, to provide education that reflects what people do if they graduate with science or engineering degrees. And it picks up on what was said earlier today. The practice of engineering can take many forms. It's not a sin to be educated as an engineer and do something quite different from engineering. And yet, I think our habit, to use Professor Silby's term, has acculturated us to think that, oh my, if you are a graduate of engineering, you're not doing engineering, you somehow have left the priesthood. You've been laicized, and to use that clerical analogy. And I think that's something we really need to work on. So I certainly support Professor King, naturally, a colleague. We see this the same way, and I'm delighted that some others, particularly Professor Silby, agrees with us that the four-year engineering degree is going to disappear one day, because four-year baccalaureate engineering work is going to be done offshore.
Chris Boudreau, it's going to take me a long time to absorb what Susan especially and also Scott indicated are the kind of habit-based impediments to what we're doing. But I want to offer some tactical, but it's really interesting. Some tactical suggestions following on what Alice said the other day, a little while ago, and that is I think that the humanists and the humanists in particular and the engineers are, if not yearning towards something, then being pushed in a direction that's going to bring us together. And you all know about AVET and the intercultural communication and teams and ethics and all of that. In my field, and I before WPI, I came from a large PhD granting English department, which gave me a lot of dismay because there just aren't jobs out there. But my disciplines are looking for ways of applying what they do, so they're not just writing academic books and journals for a shrinking audience. A journal last year of studies in philosophy, the whole journal was devoted to applied philosophy. There are new journals out there. Public history has been a subfield in history for some time now, and even my disciplinary organization, the Modern Language Association, their presidential theme this year is literature and its audiences, and it's about trying to figure out more, better, different audiences beyond just the academic scholarly audience. So we're looking for ways to make our work relevant. Not everyone in our discipline, the woman John Orr referred to, who said, "John, all I have is words," she's one of mine, and she's not going to budge, but there are lots of us who are looking to be relevant without giving up on the knowledge for its own sake. So do look for us.
I want to applaud your comments. I think they're right on the mark. I'd like to tell a little story, however, and then others can tell me why this is wrong. Several years ago, I sat on an evaluation committee at MIT to evaluate, I think I can say it out loud, the Engineering Systems Division. It was an 8-person committee of 2 social scientists and 6 engineers. I don't think there was a scientist. And this experiment in research and teaching was to focus specifically on socio-technical systems, the kind of thing that Leon was talking about. They had within their orbit 4 master's programs, one of which was the TPP that Leon was talking about. Well, frankly, we wrote a very negative evaluation. We said that they had vibrancy, they had enthusiasm, they had an interesting idea, but they didn't know what was the socio-technical. When we would ask them, what's a socio-technical system? Any system that has a large component of the social was, quote, the definition. And we would say, and this is 6 engineers and 2 social scientists, we would say, what doesn't, what system except maybe a thermostat doesn't have a large component of the social? They were studying medicine. They were studying mental health. They were studying supply chains. They were studying everything. That's fine. And we said, where's the social science? You don't have any social scientists. My observation is that you've got the solution, but frankly, and now many, I'm not going to say all, of my colleagues and department chairs, not all, at MIT do not want social scientists or humanists teaching. When there are engineers who want social science and humanities, they want to teach it themselves. They want their faculty to get larger. And when we gave this report to the then dean, who's not dean anymore, gone off to be president of a university, he said, and I quote, "You want me to hire social scientists into this? I don't want to be a second-rate Sloan School." That's the School of Management. So he didn't want social scientists because it would demean the quality of engineering.
Okay. Just one more question, then we're off to lunch. So
please. Sharon Jones, University of Portland. I realize I stand between you and lunch. So this is just a quick example that I think illustrates the pre-med model that Professor King was referring to. So a couple of years ago, University of Portland is primarily a teaching-oriented school with some master's programs, and the engineering school was charged with increasing the graduate population. You could imagine the faculty were up in arms against doing this because they all came to teach undergrads. So anyway, to make a long story short, we ended up, there was a champion for biomedical engineering at the graduate level. We formed a committee across the university that developed not only the curriculum for the biomedical engineering program, but a list of prerequisites for that program. And the distinction in terms of the prerequisites is that this was to be open regardless of undergraduate major. So the first cohort starts in May, and we just went through the applications for the program. We had over 50 applications for 15 spots. The vast majority of those 50 applications were from non-engineers. And to conclude the story, as we presented the summary data to the chairs in the engineering program, the comments came back, "Oh, wow, these students are really very well qualified. Look at the GRE scores. Look at the average average GPAs. Look at what they've done. And wow, they did well in those engineering prerequisite courses that they took over the last year. How could we do this for our other graduate programs?" And so that's an example of the type of change that I think could help this overall movement. So.
Great, thank you. Well, let's thank our panel and all of you for such great questions, panelists, and it's time for lunch.